Welcome to this podcast from the September 8, 2014 meeting of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. This podcast was recorded in Washington, D.C. and is from the second session titled Potential New Approaches for the Next Era of College Sports. This session explored ideas, concepts, and principles that could help guide future changes in college sports competition and the treatment of athletes. Introducing panelists for this session is William Britt Kerwin, Chancellor of the University System of Maryland and co-chair of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. This session lasts approximately 1 hour and 38 minutes. For more information on the Knight Commission, please visit knightcommission.org.
With us today, first is Mike Gillerin, who's the Executive Director, Santa Clara University Institute for Sports Law and Ethics, and former commissioner of the West Coast Conference. He's on the left there, my left. Oliver Luck, who is the Director of Athletics at West Virginia University. Alan Ashley, Chief of Sports Performance for the U.S. Olympic Committee. Sandy Hatfield Club, who's the Director of Athletics at Drake University. And Dan Beebe, well known to us, all of us on the commission. He's now president of the Dan Beebe Group. He's a former commissioner of the Big 12 Conference and the Ohio Valley Conference. So we will just go in that order, and Mike will let you begin.
Thank you very much. It's a thrill to be here, and I thoroughly enjoyed the first presentation. I should add that as of a week ago, I'm now a high school athletics director at Archbishop Reardon High School, so the youth sports issues are now paramount in my mind. I wanted to begin. Amy had asked if I would mention briefly work that the Institute is doing in the area of women's soccer concussions studies, and to tie in with Brian's remarks, we've found frightening data that strongly suggests that our young girls are in considerable danger with repetitive heading exercises. We've partnered with the Sports Legacy Institute out of Boston in an effort to attempt to change the culture of youth soccer for boys and girls. And we've introduced an idea that has yet not received much traction, that is to preclude heading prior to high school. We're getting tremendous pushback from coaches who tell us that we're un-American, that we've damned the opportunities for future World Cup success. My own soccer career ended in high school. But we have a board member, Brandi Chastain, who's truly an icon in women's soccer, and she's come 180 degrees on this. Brandi started by suggesting that we can coach ourselves to a better outcome. She now believes that, no, we need to stop, as coaches, we need to stop the practice of heading. The kids aren't physically ready for it. So we're involved with that, and I would urge any of you who are so interested to look at some of the research, and to the extent that you are influential in that area, my selfish interest is that we could, in fact, slow our kids down a bit. They don't need to be spending a great deal of time in practice with repetitive heading, especially the young girls. The Institute of Sports Law and Ethics at Santa Clara University is not designed to take one position and hold strongly to it. At our symposium in 2012, we focused on issues involving college athletics, and we invited speakers across the spectrum. Joan O'Sara of the New York Times has been a vociferous critic of the NCAA. We had hoped to balance Joe with President Emmert. Mark couldn't make it. He sent Wally Renfro, so we had an NCAA policymaker to present that side of it. They each had an opportunity to meet each other at the speaker's dinner and realize that the other guy wasn't the devil, and so that helped inform the discussions. Amy Perko was one of our speakers that day. Amy did a great job. we had asked one of our board members, David Drummond, who's a chief legal officer at Google and a former student athlete at Santa Clara University. We'd asked David to be the lunchtime speaker, and he was graciously willing to do that for us. We didn't know what he was going to say, so we have stolen from David's ideas, quite frankly, in our paper. David presented us with a potential new model. He said, you know, let's not assume that anything is off the table. We live here in Silicon Valley. We're surrounded by innovation every day. That's pretty much what shapes life in the Bay Area now. And why don't we think about possible outcomes with an eye toward getting ideas out on the table for smarter people than us to consider? David likened what we're facing in college athletics to challenges that faced institutions back in the day with technology. And so he said the issues we face in intellectual property are analogous to what we face in college. The term technology transfer refers to what institutions have done for many years now, allowing student inventors to participate in the marketplace, to share in the revenue they generate. And David suggested we consider that as a model for our student athletes. So the paper that three of us drafted is not a position paper by the Institute. It's just three guys sitting around saying, what if? The other two guys are much smarter than I am. Ron Katz, Rhodes Scholar, Harvard Law, represented NFL retired players to the tune of $28 million settlement. And Ron's a thinker and a doer. Isaac Vaughn, former student athlete, again at Santa Clara University, attorney who has been involved in a lot of mergers and acquisitions in Silicon Valley, and a teammate of David Drummond's back in the day. So the three of us sat down and said, let's work along the lines of the 9 points paper that several distinguished universities developed in the IP issues and see what we come up with. You have either had a chance to read it or will, I hope, soon read it. And you can draw your own conclusions as to whether you think there's any merit to what we suggest. When we drafted this, we knew, of course, there was an O'Bannon case in the pipeline, and we anticipated others to follow. We knew there would be something happening in NCAA governance. We didn't know what. So it wasn't like we were on the cutting edge of anything. We knew those issues and those challenges were out there. To cut to the chase on our paper, we're suggesting that we recognize that that there are some schools, a few, granted, that have recognized significant revenue. We're suggesting that they be allowed to pursue what we call a business model. And we're suggesting that the other schools, the vast majority of other institutions, may find that the NCAA model, as amateurism is currently defined, makes perfect sense for them, and they ought to be allowed to continue that. We're well aware that the knee-jerk reaction from me, for example, as somebody who spent a lifetime in Division I, we say things like level playing field and recruiting advantage and all that. But the fact is, when I had another job, and it was Santa Clara recruiting a kid versus Stanford. Well, Stanford's going to get that kid, and they probably should. So we know we don't have any model that results in perfect competitive equity, but we're suggesting that we do allow young men and young women who generate revenue the opportunity to participate in that. Of course, as with anything, the cliche is true, the devil is in the details. We acknowledge that Title IX is an issue that would have to be dealt with under any new model. My personal preference is that we allow men and women who are marketable to participate in the marketplace, so it's gender neutral. I don't know if that has any legs even within the Institute. We recognize that that it's easy to criticize the NCAA, and that certainly was never, that's never my initial reaction. I loved my time at the NCAA, and I'm eternally grateful for the wonderful people I met and worked with. And I know we're all trying. It's just difficult in this current climate to get our hands around these difficult issues, and given the scope of litigation that's out there and coming down the road, it's gonna be an ongoing effort for you all to try to get your arms around it. It's tremendously difficult, but we think that there is merit in looking at a system that's worked in the field of IP. And so we put it out there for you, for you and for others who are so inclined to want to look at it. Again, fully realizing we probably don't have all the answers, and I'm not sure if anybody does. And acknowledging that litigation will shape much of what happens. So I'll stop now because I'm mindful of the time constraints, and we have some great speakers. And I'll look forward to any questions you might have at the end. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Mike. Oliver.
Thank you, Dr. Turner. Good morning. As I took the cab over this morning from Reagan National Airport, you kind of go through Foggy Bottom. I think I'm not a native Washingtonian, but it reminded me of Harry Truman's Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, who presided with President Truman over the creation of the New World Order post-World War II, and he wrote the book Present at the Creation. And as an athletic director going on my fifth year, I really feel as though we're present at the creation of a new relationship between our universities, the NCAA as an umbrella organization, and our student athletes. And like Dr. Hainlein mentioned, it's absolutely important that we get this right. There are a lot of outside forces, again, much like there was in the late 40s and 1950s, a lot of outside forces creating this structure. But as I think about the O'Bannon lawsuit and the many other lawsuits that have been filed, as I think about the labor application by the Northwestern football players, as I think about the new governance model that will be launched, of course, this fall, I realize that we do have a tremendous opportunity to get it right, but I think we have to get it right. As a practicing athletic director, I try to keep three principles in mind as I go about my daily business, and let me share those and maybe a couple of sub-points, again, also being very mindful of the time here. Number one, I think our most important job in college athletics, big school, small school, doesn't matter, is to provide a platform for the academic success of our student athletes. Very few student athletes will go on to play professional sports. Professional sports is very difficult to do. Len Elmore, Myron, we can all speak about that in our own val, in our own unique ways. We need to prepare our kids for success, and that means academic success in the universities. And to do that, we need to do what a number of universities have already launched, lifetime scholarships. I think if a young man or a young woman gives us 4 or 5 years of a lot of time and effort, competitions, that we need to reward that with a lifetime scholarship, including graduate school. I would be honored, quite honestly, to take West Virginia University athletic funds to pay for law school, medical school, and MBA for our student athletes. They've sacrificed for us. All of us who played at the college level realize that, and even those who didn't play at the college level realize that, and I think that would be something that would be incumbent upon us to do that. We need to provide better academic support during their playing career. And we also need to do a better job of identifying the real challenges for many student athletes. And in my mind, that's midweek competitions. We need to limit midweek competitions as much as we possibly can. As Dr. Hainlein mentioned, if that means stretching the season out to perhaps include both semesters, that may be an option, not just from a physical standpoint, from an academic standpoint. Playing a Wednesday volleyball game in the Pac-12 and having the Stanford Cardinal fly up to Washington State only because that game should be in the Pac-12 network, I think is doing a disservice to volleyball players. The second point that I want to emphasize as I go about my daily business, I don't think that we want to create an employer-employee relationship with our student athletes. I think that's a path that will have cascade of unintended consequences. I do, though, believe that we need to enhance the value of the traditional scholarship that we're giving our young men and women. And by enhanced value, I mean not only the full cost of attendance. which is something that I think is coming down the pike regardless, given the momentum that that issue has. But as Dr. Hanline mentioned, better mental health counseling, better physical health care after their playing careers are over, something that's been dismissed, I suppose, it just hasn't been accomplished very well over the years, is better career training. Our student-athletes spend so much time training, and even in the off-season. What are our college baseball players do in the off-season? They all go play in the wooden bat leagues in Cape Cod and other places up north because they love to play baseball. They have no time to really spend in an internship to figure out what accountants really do or what lawyers may do or what educators may do when they're not in the classroom. So I think we need to do a much better job of creating real, legitimate career training for our student athletes. The third point I would like to make is that I think we need to acknowledge that certainly amongst the larger schools, the 65 schools now in this autonomous group, the five conferences, that intercollegiate athletics, particularly football and men's basketball, and increasingly women's basketball and very often baseball, they are big-time businesses. I think we need to acknowledge that. We need to accept that fact, and we need to look at running them as big-time businesses to really maximize the revenue that we can. And I say this with all humility. It was mentioned twice, I think, in the earlier session about the potential decline in the interest of football, whether it's from participants or from fans, right, because of the concussion issue. I think we need to take a look at a number of our sports that presently aren't considered revenue generators, and I'm thinking of men's soccer, I'm thinking of women's soccer, I'm thinking of lacrosse, I'm thinking of baseball, all sports where there is a professional league, and in many cases that professional league has done relatively well. Major League Baseball has been making money, minor league baseball has been making money now for probably well over a century, but I think we need to look at those sports and try to determine if there's not a better platform to make those sports revenue generating without impairing in any way the experience of the student athlete. I think we need to broaden our revenue base and not rely so heavily on football and on men's basketball for the revenue at the college level. I think there are a number of issues that have been discussed today. I'll tell you that I read Mike's IP approach to student athlete revenue in terms of licensing and royalties, and I think there may be something in it. There's absolutely nothing wrong, I think, with looking at our enterprise as a big business enterprise and acknowledging that fact and doing many of the things, quite honestly, that our professional leagues are doing. Whatever happens at the pro leagues ends up filtering down to the college level. That's been the case over the last 15, 20, 25 years, and I think it's something that we should look at very closely. And with that, I'll turn over my comments in the platform to Alan. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Oliver. Alan?
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss this important topic today with the Commission. Perhaps there's nothing more important to the success of Team USA than at the Olympic Games than American collegiate sports. And while I believe it's important for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is to inspire the next generation, winning clearly isn't everything for us. I personally was fortunate enough to be a student athlete at the University of Colorado as a skier, and then went on to be a coach. And because of that experience, I'm sitting here before you today. It really shaped me as a person and shaped the opportunities I have had in sports and in athletics. We really rely on collegiate sports in the Olympic movement. If you look at our statistics from London, 65% of our athletes, which were on the Olympic team in London, were student athletes. They won 28 medals. And if you look at the cumulative effect of not only athletes from the United States, but athletes from all countries, student athletes from the Pac-12 had 88 medals, 50 of them gold. The SEC and Big Ten had 88 medals combined, and the SEC, Big Ten, and Big 12 had 50 gold medals. So not only is collegiate athletics impacting Team USA and our performance on the field of play, it's having a profound impact on the movement worldwide. So really, I can't emphasize enough right now in the changing business environment and really looking at how potentially the world will change in collegiate athletics, how that's going to impact Team USA and really our future. It's an important time for us, too, to remember that most of the rest of the world is coming on strong in the Olympic Games. Countries like China and Russia have government-funded programs, something we don't have in this country, who are helping athletes with tens of millions of dollars in athlete support so that they can go out and compete successfully internationally. We're fortunate in this country because we have such an excellent collegiate system, a system that ultimately is an integral part of our pipeline in sports like swimming, wrestling, gymnastics, field hockey, you know, track and field, you name it. We have a huge influence, and that's why you see so many athletes emerge from collegiate programs onto Team USA and representing our country at the Olympic Games. My concern right now, you know, to be blunt about it, is that with the change in the business model, we are really going to have a tough time seeing Olympic sport survive. As many of you know, Olympic sport is often considered non-revenue sports, and that's not, of course, to be the case in all instances. And as we've just mentioned, I mean, there are revenue opportunities, and I think those are things we have to really explore. But if the business model does change, we need to be able to come up with ways to react to it positively so that we can maintain student-athletes on these campuses and in these programs. I can tell you we are very committed to working with colleges and universities, with athletic directors, with the conference commissioners, and certainly with the Knight Commission, to find creative, unique, new ways to basically preserve the student-athletes on the college campuses that compete in our Olympic teams. Few ideas on this, things that I think, you know, we're going to explore, and one of the things we'd really like to do is we're going to form a working group. We've been just starting to reach out to individual institutions, and we kind of started off with the institutions which had historically contributed significantly to Team USA and to the Olympic team, so that we could find out what is special about having Olympians on campus. How can we as the U.S. Olympic Committee activate with the institutions to continue to come up with ways to enhance and potentially promote Olympians on campus, because we really share a lot of the same values, you know, friendship, respect, and excellence, which are the values of the Olympic movement and really the values of many athletic departments and many programs throughout our country. So ways that we can, you know, potentially look towards the future and grow our relationship is, you know, build fundraising programs with universities that leverage the Olympic brand. We have a program called Olympic Training Sites where we designate facilities and venues around the country that are integral to the development of athletes in some of our sports. We call them Olympic Training Sites. They're able to use that moniker, and it helps them to fundraise and helps them to gain notoriety and helps our sports and our athletes to absolutely have the best training venues. We want to use our national governing bodies. We have about 13 million members when you look at all 48 sports. In our national governing bodies, and there's ways that we can help to activate with those memberships and help to use the national governing bodies, the NGBs, to promote sports, promote events, potentially even get together and do joint events where, you know, an NCAA championship along with a national championship, which are complete, you know, currently in many cases being run independently, could be run together, which would make it more viable economically and would actually create a revenue stream to help support it. We can jointly conduct programs for officials and coaches. We can encourage our important partner, NBC, to help promote where athletes have come from that are on the Olympic team, which schools they participated in, so that it brings notoriety and respect to those institutions. And really continue to figure out creative ways to develop kind of unique models by sport. I think one of the things, certainly coming from a skiing background, that I noticed was the rules are often very standardized and applied across the board to all sports. And if we can come up with unique and different ways to approach, especially the Olympic sports, in ways that the rules are more collaborative and more compatible with how we're training athletes on the Olympic movement, it would really help us. As I said, we've started to kind of meet with individual athletic directors to get feedback and information about their business model, how we can be helpful. We're also ready to put resources behind this. We haven't committed a specific dollar amount yet, but our objective is to make sure that when we do find ways that we can activate on campus, that the U.S. Olympic Committee is standing by the institutions and figuring out a way to use our resources. The final thing I want to say is that beyond kind of preserving Olympic sport on the university campuses, we need to have a dialogue about the role we each play in creating a healthy setting for sport. There's two things we're working on. One is that there was quite a bit of discussion earlier about specialization early on. We've been working with the Aspen Institute and Tom Ferry on a project called Project Play, which is designed to start to really figure out ways to try to move away from specialization for kids under 12, give them an opportunity to try a lot of sports, and set up the rules and the organization around sport on the local and community level so that people won't feel such a heavy pressure to specialize early. I think one of the things that was really interesting, we ran a survey of our Olympians, and one of the questions we asked was, were you a multi-sport athlete growing up? And overwhelmingly, they reported back that that was one of the key things for them. They played a lot of sports when they were young. They had good physical literacy. They had good technical literacy. And then they didn't specialize until they got a little older. So it was a very telltale sign of our greatest athletes and success in in the Olympic movement that they are multi-sport athletes. The other piece of this is that there is no agency or commission today that is responsible for the safety and well-being of young athletes. Far too many young boys and girls will be sexually abused in sports settings and before they turn 18. So earlier this summer, the U.S. Olympic Committee announced that it's going to financially support the creation of a new independent entity. The entity will have two primary functions, education and awareness on the one hand, and investigation on the other hand. All of our national governing bodies have signed on with this effort. They're going to get it behind it financially with the U.S. Olympic Committee. And it'll really provide for an open dialogue and provide resources for training and for this investigation that currently don't exist anywhere. We've asked the NCAA to be a part of it. We're looking for philanthropy and others to join us in this effort because it is an expensive piece of business to do to set up this organization. But it is really, really important, I think, that the U.S. Olympic Committee take a lead in this effort. And so by setting up this organization, the Center for Safe Sport, we're going to take that lead. So with that, I'm going to conclude and turn it over to Sandra. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Sandy?
Thank you, Alan. And thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. It's an honor for me to speak on behalf of the coaches, administrators, students, and faculty at Drake University. We have a complex model in our approach to intercollegiate athletics at Drake. So I've written my comments in an effort to keep within my 8 to 10 minute limit. It's critical now more than ever that Division I intercollegiate athletics leaders articulate how athletics serves as a fundamental part of the educational mission of our institutions. At Drake University, the express purpose of college sports is more than a place for athletically talented students to express themselves as a student and as an athlete. It's more than a gathering place for our students, our fans, and our alumni. It's more than a marketing tool for our university. Intercollegiate athletics is a platform for intellectual development that serves as a meaningful part of higher education for more than 350 students at Drake University. There are three important components to the Division I sports at Drake. One, a co-curricular approach to athletics that's designed to be a fundamental part of a student-athlete's learning experience. Two, a comprehensive assessment process. And three, an intentional culture that promotes excellence, ethics, and accountability. Drake's model of Division I athletics is centered in a co-curricular approach where sport is a fundamental part of the student-athlete's comprehensive learning experience. As directed by the university's strategic plan, athletics is being transformed from an extracurricular to a co-curricular experience. Implementation of this concept can only happen with the full engagement of the provost office, key faculty, coaches, and athletics administrators. This work centers in a shared belief that Division I athletics provides an extraordinary platform for developing students intellectually as world-class leaders. and that the coaches serve an important teaching role that expands beyond the game. Please don't misunderstand, this is not a belief that all of our faculty share. It certainly has been met with some resistance. But there are key faculty that are moving this concept forward with the vision of an engaged provost and president. To give you examples of the co-curricular work that's taking place at Drake, foreign tours have become real global learning experiences with curriculum expressly designed to enhance the intellectual experience of student athletes. For example, we took our football team to Tanzania in 2011 to play in the Global Kilimanjaro Bowl. With our Mexican opponent, our team performed clinics for 500 youth, engaged in three full days of service, and climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. All this while studying emotional intelligence taught by professors in the College of Business and the School of Education. As another example, two international business faculty will lead a study abroad course for our men's and women's soccer programs to compete in Guadalajara, Mexico in the upcoming 2015 January term. Please understand, these are rigorous courses taught by highly respected faculty. What I believe will be the hallmark of Drake University's co-curricular approach is being piloted this semester. The university offers an interdisciplinary concentration in leadership. One section of the introductory course is being taught for student athletes only. If this semester goes well, all student athletes will take this course, and student athletes that continue in the concentration will study their sport as their leadership platform under the guidance of our faculty and our coaches. To further demonstrate how the athletics model is being valued on Drake's campus, a faculty development program has been started and is funded through our provost office, through which faculty are learning from head coaches how to coach in their classroom. The commission has been provided a Chronicle of Higher Education article written by the creator of Coaching in the Classroom and the Drake faculty member, Dr. Craig Owens. The second component of Drake's approach to Division I athletics is a comprehensive assessment process that helps us to first determine if intercollegiate athletics is meeting the learning outcomes that characterize a Drake education, and two, to assess how the program actualizes the university's mission. The commission has received a copy of the Quick Guide for Leaders. It's a description within which there's a description of the assessment process found on page 16. The assessment tools are designed in collaboration between the university's Director of Academic Assessment, athletic administrators, and our consultants from the Institute for Excellence and Ethics. In brief, the Bulldog Index of Conditions for Excellence and Performance, affectionately known as the BICEP, it evaluates our character competencies, compares student athletes to general data on leadership, character, academic performance, graduation, and retention, and it measures our team performance. It is a work in progress, and in its early stages is providing excellent feedback to understand and improve our culture and our performance. It is the third element of Drake's approach to Division I athletics that drives the first and the second components, and that is the intentional culture that promotes excellence, ethics, and accountability. Research informs us that culture plays a significant role in shaping both moral and performance character. As a result, it is imperative that we work intentionally to shape our culture. The foundation of Drake Athletics culture is our touchstone, the Bulldog Way. That was created and is driven through the leadership of our head coaches. These are the tenets that guide our actions, our every decision. They guide who we recruit and who we hire and who stays within our Bulldog family. They guide how we treat and care for one another. They guide how we play and how we dream. They guide how we measure our progress, and they are the tenets through which more than 400 members of our Bulldog family are held accountable. Core structures have been developed to ensure that the culture becomes pervasive throughout our entire athletics program. The Quick Guide for Leaders describes each of our core structures and as well as the research theory that supports our work. At the very center of our core structures is our Bulldog Way playbook. Each member of the Bulldog family receives a playbook, and in the fall of each year, we participate in a commitment ceremony, at which time we make a public commitment to live the Bulldog Way. by signing a huge copy of it that's displayed throughout the year in the public halls of our Bell Center. All the work that we do to integrate the Bulldog Way culture is internally focused. It was not designed as a marketing tool or to be outwardly facing. As we accomplish our goals and reach our dreams, it will be our demonstration of both moral and performance character that will ultimately market our program. As a result, the Quick Guide for Leaders has not been shared outside our immediate family before today. It's provided to the Commission for your reference only. The Bulldog Way Playbook, it's designed around the tenets of our touchstone, and much like a coach's playbook, it is never shared outside the family. In this highly accountable, pervasive culture that ties the coaches and staff into our co-curricular model, it defines them as leadership educators, and most importantly, it links our body of work to what drives Division I athletics, and that is winning. And it is working at Drake. We have just entered our fourth year in the Bulldog Way. Our assessment shows us making progress in our culture, our character, and record academic performance. We are now on the horizon of what we knew would be our last measure to follow, and that is athletics performance. When we prove we can maintain this level of intensity and focus on whole person development and win, it is then that we will have created a new model for Division I athletics. Intercollegiate athletics is a billion-dollar industry with an extraordinary focus in our American society. It's incumbent upon us as leaders to leverage this power of sport to serve humanity by actualizing the fundamental purpose of higher education, to develop knowledge and innovation and prepare citizens that will advance our common good. Our athletics programs must bring a deeper meaning to our student athletes and the broader campus than dribbling a ball or throwing a tight spiral. Integrity, honor, dignity, and respect must continue to be the core values on which college athletics stands. I'm in full agreement with Dr. Handline that our issues are a result of human behavior and not our governance structures. I cannot complete my comments without recognizing President David Maxwell, Provost Denise Jones and her senior leadership, our partners at the Institute for Excellence in Ethics, as well as Character Counts in Iowa, and most importantly, our Bulldog family led by our head coaches and senior staff. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today.
Thank you, Sandy. Dan?
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here and see a lot of good old friends. Jeff and Mike are two of them that I got the pleasure to serve with. If you want to use this as an opportunity for a bathroom break, I won't be offended. First of all, I just want to speak to the fact that since I left the Big 12, I formed a company that has provided consulting, worked with Val at the Big East and others, Jack DeJoy as well. But our primary focus is to help with what Alan alluded to, with helping organizations address misconduct, primarily related to harassment, discrimination, sex abuse, sexual molestation, and those a number of wrongful termination and those kind of issues. So we're risk managers. My team and I, and I'm honored to say that we are helping the USOC with the creation for the Center for Safe Sport to achieve insurance for their entity and also help advise on how it could be set up. And I think for any of you that are interested, they're creating a great model for independent experts to be involved in very sensitive issues of misconduct that really is one that all American institutions and professional sports and others need to look at carefully. It's in the embryonic stages. Well, actually, it's further along than that, but I think it's something to really pay attention to because they really are on the forefront in what we've seen with American institutions in trying to address issues related to misconduct in these areas. So compliments to you and the USOC. I'm a former commissioner who doesn't have a lot at risk to throw out radical ideas. So I'm going to do that, knowing that I'm still trying to work in the space. And some of you say, well, he's too big of a nutcase to bring him in and help with us. But I've been vexed for a number of years with the issues that are really kind of outlined by what Oliver said in regard to working at institutions that have achieved a lot of resources, and I was responsible for being a part of that, negotiating billion-dollar contracts as a Big 12 commissioner, member of the men's basketball committee, member of the BCS. We were very successful in bringing in a lot of money for a certain level of institutions. Also served longer period of time and competed at a level with regional state universities like I was commissioner of the Ohio Valley Conference. So the issues that are vexing me are ones that are related to all of the enhancements that probably are due to student athletes that are participating in sports that are bringing in a net revenue. People like to say, well, there's revenue producing sports, but do they really bring in a net revenue? And those institutions that, frankly, if they're going to provide those enhancements, they're going to come from taxing the other students or the taxpayers themselves. As commissioner of the Ohio Valley Conference, it was somewhat more of a more comfortable position to be able to look every single student athlete in the eye and say, your experience here is being paid for in part by your fellow students or taxpayers, so you need to be grateful for everything you're getting. And I participated at that level. But yet, there's enough athletes now where you see competition that's pretty good between a McNeese State last weekend and Nebraska. McNeese State takes Nebraska down to the wire, and I guarantee you they're not a football program that makes more money than it costs to fund it. So we have that issue, and then I think Allen's issue is another one that's vexed me. How do we continue to have a broad base of sports that help support our Olympics movement? And with that, and I'll throw out my idea for a new model, knowing that it's raw, knowing that there are a lot of holes that can be poked into it, but also knowing that I don't have to be responsible for trying to formulate it, and that luck will fall to all of you to try to identify how we go from here. You know, my primary concern is about the student-athlete. I was a recruited student-athlete at Division II level, at that level where my fellow students were being taxed, you know, that's probably a crass term, for my ability to participate in student-athletes. I played at Cal Poly, had an experience there, and then I was silly enough to survive law school by joining the rugby team at University of California, Hastings. And I observed through that participation in those two sports a whole different way of conceiving how sports are done. I was trying to participate and obtain a scholarship in undergraduate school, and then when I went to law school at Hastings, we participated against Stanford, Cal, Santa Clara, Santa Barbara, a lot of those programs where I saw these young people being grateful for having the opportunity to have a field to play on, to get some travel money, perhaps have coaching, have uniforms, dedicate themselves to an athletics experience that a lot of young people don't get a chance to do. This is through the club participation, but it was still an eye-opener to me to see, and I was doing the same thing as a student at a law school, is to have the ability to dedicate myself to a sport. So that helped me understand that maybe there's a difference we have to outline here. There are spectator net revenue sports, and then there are participant-oriented sports. And perhaps there's a model that can help preserve both. Oliver's right. The pressures that are coming on are unlike any other that I've seen in intercollegiate athletics. But it isn't like we couldn't have guessed that this was going to go on with all of the activity that's happened. The realignment sacrificed a lot of principles and sacrificed some people too, me included, but sacrificed some principles that we had. And it was done primarily in at least three, if not four, of the Power Five conferences to be able to achieve a higher market value and achieve more money. And with that, though, came also the travel on a lot of the other student-athletes and the burden on the other student-athletes that weren't participating in those net revenue sports. And I think that perhaps there's a way to identify those sports where the student-athletes that produce net revenue and are in high-stakes, high-pressure, and high-stress activities, they're a lot different than I experience as a 1AA student-athlete or I saw at the FCS level or I see at other levels. Those players at the large, primarily state universities and some of the primary private institutions in football and men's basketball primarily and some in women's basketball are really under a different level of pressure. There's attention given to them every day. When I was in the Ohio Valley Conference and we had playoff games with Murray State University and I saw more people's cars in the parking lot across the street at Walmart than I did at our stadium, that isn't the same kind of pressure that the Oklahoma, Texas, and other student athletes experience. The other category of student athletes are those that are participating in what my great successor, Bob Bowlesby, calls a less adoring public following them. And perhaps if we can delineate between those two and we can form an ability to provide the benefits that Oliver indicates are needed to be provided, in fact are being required to be provided perhaps by the courts and NLRB and others, and broaden even, create more sports, don't just preserve the opportunities that are there, but bring back some sports for a lot more people to participate in the participation-oriented sports, and then create an opening for the Olympic movement and others to have some loosening of the rules as it relates to the Olympic sports. There are some factors that I think are going to be present. One, let's just assume that all of us agree that sports physical activity is good for all the student athletes that can possibly participate. And perhaps that is broadened to physical activity that we don't traditionally identify as sports. One time when I was at a NCAA tournament in Southern California, I took my daughter, who was young, and some others on the off day to Disneyland and got accosted by a mother of a number of dance team folks, her daughter and others, about how stupid we were in college athletics to not acknowledge the activities in other sports for females. And she said, here I am up in Seattle. The University of Washington has formed a rowing club. All of these young girls, they were grade schoolers or older, have participated in dance all their lives. They're committed to it. They work out hours and hours. They're as good of athletes as the others. There's no rowing programs that I know of for a younger age, yet we don't acknowledge that all of these young women or young girls could participate in some activity that's physically demanding and rewarding in some way. So maybe we need to open our eyes to other opportunities for females to be able to meet Title IX requirements as well. So I think the broader the better, the more participation opportunities the better, and that we have to acknowledge that Title IX will continue to play a role in whatever is being created in the future. My idea is to, if we identify the spectator-oriented sports, and some of this will step on the toes of some sports that think they need to be there and some don't, let's just take the ones that are the net revenue producers on the men's side, football and men's basketball, then those are the ones that you can provide full grants and aid up to cost of attendance or whatever the courts are going to finally decide, recruit off campus, have full-time coaches that are only dedicated to the sport. Competition would be on a national basis, and academic, medical support, other types of things that Oliver had mentioned would be fully provided to those student athletes in those sports, recognizing their level of competition, stress, and other activities are ones that the university benefits greatly from and should be acknowledged in the way that we treat those student athletes. Then, for the participation-oriented sports, and perhaps, you know, maybe you have 100 grants at West Virginia for the men's side and 100 grants you have to provide in the women's side, and look at possible other physical activities you can provide those grants in, and you identify those as spectator-oriented sports. You have full marketing, you sell tickets, and you do other activities. Then on the participation-oriented side, those sports that they don't have the type of adoring public and the revenue coming into the program, broaden your base, and you'll save a lot of money by doing these things that might be able to provide even a greater number of sports that can address the Olympic movement and make sure we preserve some of the sports and even bring back some that have been dropped. And you can do this by doing what Title IX asked to be done, which is accommodating the interests and abilities. As many people that want to participate can do it, and you have limited to no grant and aid and public support. You have the ability you don't have recruiting off campus. Perhaps the coaches are ones, and some of these are already being done. They're local club coaches, they're at a golf club or a tennis club or other places, or they're faculty members who are coaching. There is the ability to have the fields and other activities somewhat like the club sport level, but there's local competition and regional competition more than national competition that's provided in those sports. And the revenue that's saved can expand your program to be able to add and preserve the Olympic sports. And maybe there's a requirement to that anybody that's involved in Division I has to have a broader base program that we have already in the participation-oriented sports. The results of this could be the cost savings for expansion of the other sports, preservation of the Olympic sports support, and a partnership with Olympic sports that may allow the loosening of the rules, having endorsements for the elite athletes in the Olympic sports that can participate in the college realm, and also address the continuing pressures of the legal system, the governmental system, and others on what we're doing with those student athletes that are in the net revenue producing sports. That's offered for consideration. There might be elements of that that are attractive. There may be a lot of it or all of it that could be thrown out. And with that, I just say good luck and goodbye.
Dan, thank you very much, and to all of our panelists for your very insightful comments. You've been very disciplined and have left us ample time for some dialogue. So, Henry, you've got the first question.
Well, thank you, Britt. I'll try to be brief, maybe not so brief. But I think missing in this conversation to me are two critical elements as we think about the future of sports, the job of this commission. One is the mission of the university in non-athletics, and two is costs. And I want to come back to this by being a brief discussant, though Britt and Gerald didn't ask me to do this, of some of the conversations we've had. I did read the remarks of Mr. Drummond, and I think, Mr. Gillerin, that the Silicon tech transfer model is in some ways analogous and in some ways not. And I want to stress not for a minute. One, when you are at a major research university, you recruit your faculty, your graduate students, and even some of your undergraduates on what they can add in the way of chemistry or biology or mathematics. Maybe even in the liberal arts. You're recruiting on the basis of academic promise. And at those places, and I'd like to think I headed one of them, when we recruited athletes, we also said the same thing. We wanted people who could contribute to major athletic programs, but also who could do more than do the work. That was a minimal definition that you could get your way through, but that you'd also add to the academic community. Now, in the Silicon Valley model, you're recruiting your people up front for what they can add, and particularly at a place like Stanford or some of the California schools where there's this vibrant community, more maybe at the graduate level, but to some extent at the undergraduate level, what they can add to this community, which might in fact bring you revenues and tech transfer. They usually don't, but in some places they do. And it's an upfront thing. With regard to athletics, sure, in the revenue sports you're recruiting with the hope that they'll be successful student athletes and also add to your revenues down the line. But again, I want to come back to the fundamental mission of the university. The mission of the university, I think, has been traditionally more not athletics than athletics in terms of the way the whole mission is designed. Now, as we've come to this kind of crisis, lots of models are going to be floated. I was brought back to the AAU last year to discuss a panel on athletics where, again, the model was floated of having a dotted line, franchising sports out. So you'd have a team, it could be a professionalized team, it would have a kind of relationship to the university, but wouldn't be necessarily integral part. And you would recruit student athletes who might not be able to do the work in that model. Slightly bizarre, I think, given what the mission of the university is. So I think if you start with a question of what the mission of the university is, And that athletics has been an important part for many universities, but to some extent, at least initially, derivative. And now it's come to the point where we're asking, what is this about? And here I want to come quickly to the question of costs and widening of a revenue base that Mr. Luck and some others addressed. I assure you that at every major research university today, the budget directors and the senior finance officers are modeling out what the costs of this are going to be, not just the cost of attendance, but our California judge in O'Bannon has said you could spend up to $5,000 per player per year. Well, which players? Fractionated scholarships, non-revenue sports, as well as revenue, to be decided. We're not so sure. That's a lot of money. Even the agreement of the Big Ten with its networks, for a place like Northwestern, my eyeball figures, and I speak unofficially, would throw us into the red. And as members of the Knight Commission already know, a very few number of Division I teams have a net revenue, positive net revenue in Division I. It's what, 15%, Amy, 12%? 15 schools out of 120-odd schools. So let's keep in mind the cost. Now I want to shift very quickly to widening the revenue base. If you have, as Northwestern has had, a national champion women's lacrosse team, you'll get people at the game. And those games get filled. We have a pretty good wrestling team. I go to wrestling matches. There are a couple of hundred people in the audience. Could you market it better? Can you really expand the base? I am very doubtful. It's an empirical matter, sure. Some big hockey games, Michigan, Michigan State, will draw a huge number. Women's basketball does pretty well at some places. But it's if you look at the non-revenue sports, I am just skeptical that you, Mr. Luck, that you'll be successful. It's an empirical question. So in this climate, to think that we're going to now bring back and increase even the number of club sports, much less things with a varsity status, I just think it's wishful thinking, frankly. I don't think you're all modeling in the real cost of all this. And I'm in favor of many of these things, like improved medical insurance. I think that's critical. That should have been done long before. But now think about what the cost is going to be. Is it lifetime medical insurance for an injury sustained? Is it going to be 10 years? What's it going to be? And again, if you start thinking about all these costs built into the system, it looks pretty astounding.
Okay. Mike, Oliver, anyone else want to respond to those comments?
No, I think the very accurate cost is a concern. As Dan knows from being a former commissioner, we spend hours and hours modeling costs. And we're very concerned, certainly, about the new costs that will be added to our plate with the O'Bannon decision and full cost of attendance and all the other issues. I think, though, that there are, quite honestly, a number of revenue sports that are now considered to be a number of Olympic sports that are considered to be non-revenue sports that could become, at least if not self-sufficient, perhaps even generating some net revenue. If Major League Soccer, and I had the pleasure of running the franchise in Houston for 5 years, if Major League Soccer, in a sport that is growing very rapidly in this country, can be making money, then I don't see why there's not a model that we could look at the collegiate level for men's or women's soccer. There's a women's professional league now in its third or fourth year, where we could look at the sport of men's or women's soccer with the goal of making those sports self-sufficient. Major League Baseball has been making money for well over a century. I look at our baseball players in the summertime. What do? They all go play wooden bat leagues up in Minnesota and Alaska and Cape Cod. They continue to play baseball because they love it. I would think if there were a proposal to look at the baseball season as it is now and perhaps extend it, certainly for the northern schools, into a little bit of the summer, that, an Ohio State-Michigan three-game series on July 4th weekend would be awful attractive. A lot of people, I think, would want to go buy tickets for that game and watch. So those are somewhat radical notions, but I do think that there are some of the traditional non-revenue sports that could be bumped up to become revenue sports. And I think that's going to be crucial. Otherwise, as you point out very eloquently, we will not have the revenue to pay all the costs that are coming down the pike.
We've got Jack, DeJoya, Anita, Myron, Lynn, and Sonia in that order. So, Jack?
Sure. Two questions, one for Mr. Ashley, one for Mr. Luck. For Mr. Ashley, can you describe in a little bit more detail the threats to your business model as you were describing it? And in particular, are some of the unfolding developments that are impacting intercollegiate athletics challenging that model? Are we somehow contributing to some of the challenges that you're facing? And then for Oliver, could you offer a little bit more, some further reflections on how you'd reconcile the tensions within your three principles? Because I think some would argue, we wrestle with that in the context of this commission, that that your third principle, that commitment, that acknowledgement that we are wrestling with big businesses, is in fact undermining the first principle, that commitment to academic integrity and academic performance, and is in fact leading to a challenge to your second principle. And I'd be grateful for how you think about reconciling the tensions inherent within those three. Mr. Ashley.
So the business model I'm referring to really is, if you look at the Olympic sports and the ones that really rely on the universities and colleges for development, the system has worked really well for us from the standpoint that we've had these athletes that emerge through. They have good coaching, they have good training programs, they're basically emerging through the college systems into a place where they can compete internationally as just part of the natural progression in our country. And so we actually, as the U.S. Olympic Committee, don't have a stake in that right now. It's happening because of the systems we've had in our country. If the business models change for the member institutions from the standpoint of how they have to take their limited revenues and disperse them, what I'm most concerned about is the fact that that could impact their ability to support men's gymnastics, field hockey, just you name the sports that are ultimately kind of lined up that really use the college system as their feeder program. If that feeder program becomes interrupted, we're going to have to come up with a new way to get those athletes great coaching, great training, and education. We're going to have to come up with some new ideas on how to sustain that, and I think that that's really what we've got to kind of look for together is how do we help the member institutions make that possible? Because I think that in many of my conversations that I've had with athletic directors, they love the Olympic sports on campus. They like having Olympians as part of their student body. It makes people excited about the institution and about the universities, but they also have the realities they have to deal with in terms of the finances. And so what we're trying to figure out is how do we work together so that if as these things change and as the economic model changes, that we have ways to react to it that maintain and sustain these great programs for these Olympic athletes.
I would acknowledge that there will always be, and I think always has been, some pretty significant tension between the big business aspect of intercollegiate athletics and the focus on the student athlete. And I'll just use the conference networks as an example. The revenue from those networks is significant. Those networks are providing a lot of substance, if you will, to the member universities of the conferences, but I think that's when you see the incremental creep of the network's needs, which is often content, games, typically in the Olympic sports during the week, and we're athletic directors, and I'll plead guilty, even though the Big 12 doesn't have a network, we're all subject to this similar pressures, but where the needs of the student athlete are being compromised. And I think, number one, we need a stronger stand, if you will, to protect our student athletes from what I think is a very challenging thing, which is midweek games. It's very difficult to have a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Thursday contest during the course of a season multiple times. So I think there will always be some tension, sort of the tension between faith and reason, I suppose. But we ultimately, I think, need to better protect the needs of the student athlete, because we I think all say this, and I think we all agree with this, but sometimes we compromise too often. We want to give those kids a great academic opportunity, a great academic experience, and putting a kid on a plane on a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Thursday, missing 2 days or 3 days of school is a real challenge, only because, let's say, a network wants to broadcast a volleyball match live.
Anita?
One example, women's rowing is protecting men's football 9 years straight. The women are world champions, and it's because of this program, absolutely because of this program. The huge feeder system, great coach, but the huge feeder system, because there's so many schools now that have women rowing. 9 years undefeated in the eight is unheard of in this sport. My question, I'm pretty sure the Sun would still come up, but what if we had a world of collegiate sport where the amateur rule was gone? The Olympic world gave up the word amateur in 1973 and replaced it with eligible based on the definition of a sport, the International Sports Federation. Why do we have a group of students who are treated so differently from others and they have to be, quote, amateur? Can we release this notion, and wouldn't that make a huge difference in the way sports is constructed at the collegiate level?
Who wants to take that one on?
Well, I have the least risk up here. If you're talking about releasing it in terms of just what the Kessler suit is trying to do, which is open up the marketplace, the difficulty I have, and I was deposed in the Abandon case and brought this up as well, is in the professional world, you know, no other country has the amateur sports that are tied to higher education. In the professional world, they, you know, don't have the lid on, they have the collective bargaining agreement, but they disperse their talent through the draft. So with certain of these sports meaning so much to their institutions, unless there's a way to disperse the talent, then I think it's going to be very problematic. You'll see only a very few member institutions that are willing to pay a heck of a lot of money to certain student athletes. You know, in some ways, the amateur model is being transformed anyway. But I think, and if we're going to continue to have the higher education system with intercollegiate athletics, and we're primarily talking about football and men's basketball, where, you know, recruitment is going on rather than a draft. If we're prepared in American society to tell the kid from Houston, congratulations, you know, you got drafted, now you got to go play in Minnesota, you know, then and here's your, you know, now we'll negotiate the salary. Then I think we might be able to do that, but I just don't think it's going to be, you know, whatever you want to call it, the college model or something, there has to be some ability or we're not going to have the competition that we've enjoyed, and maybe that's what a lot of people don't care about. My model is to try to address, you know, broadening the Olympic sports by not necessarily, by having more of an Ivy League model, need-based aid and so forth for the participant-oriented sports, and even have more of the sports, or preserve wrestling or bring wrestling back and some of the others that have gone away because of the costs. Because what I'm hearing from my friends that are in the Power 5 level is even at that level, with the judgments that are coming down and so forth, they're going to have to make hard decisions about what sports are going to have on campus if they're going to continue to fund them like they are trying to fund them now and provide all the resources that they're doing for all the programs. And that's why I think there has to be a really hard look at whether we bifurcate some of these types of sports programs.
Myron?
I just want to thank everyone, all the panelists for coming today and speaking. My question is specifically to our two college athletic directors. I went to high school in Princeton, New Jersey, at a boarding school, actually, with Jeff's son. We were classmates. And I chose to go to Florida State University. I wore ascots and bow ties. A lot of my teammates had dreadlocks and gold teeth. So it was a whole different kind of experience. My question is to you guys in the sense that many of my teammates were impoverished football players, and most of them were black and African American. To them, their families, their communities, their loved ones, college was sort of a novelty. It was a stopping ground, I guess, to your professional career in a sense. And even sometimes college was a way for you to have some immediate financial gain, because agents and runners of agents would come to these players and provide them with funds and give them different things so they can survive and make it on a college environment. So my question to you guys is, these kind of athletes, these student athletes come to you. Do you have a different approach for these sort of student-athletes from this particular demographic so we can see either an assimilation into the culture that you desire, as you mentioned at Drake, you know, your platform that you have for the desired student-athlete, or maybe even just transform some of these impoverished student-athletes, some of these minority student-athletes, so that when they go back to their families and their communities at home, their families and friends don't even recognize them because they see that, okay, college wasn't just a stopover, wasn't a place to make money, it wasn't a novelty, it was kind of something that really impacted their life and changed the trajectory of where they go. So my question is to both of you guys.
What you're referring to is a real issue, and I'm thinking about Dr. Handline's comments about the student-athlete identity issue and not seeing themselves as a soulful person. I think there's a combination of a number of things that happen. I spent 16 years at Arizona State before being at Drake, so definitely saw a different group of young people recruited there than I see at Drake. So that combined with also what we see in terms of the education system and what young people are taught and how they're moved along. Talented athlete, charming, and they come lesser prepared to the campus. And absolutely, we have to have special, if you will, focus on what those young people need to develop so that they are transformed at the college level to have an experience that would cause them to start to value themselves differently and to value the educational experience that's in front of them. And that, if I'm speaking specifically about what we're doing at Drake, we recruit a different student athlete at Drake than we did at Arizona State. But this model, I absolutely believe, could be scalable and sustainable. But there's something that we lack in Division I athletics, and that's patience. And if we don't see an immediate return on our investment, then we're quick to eliminate. So, for example, at Drake University, Dr. Tom Davis came and helped build our basketball program out of a 20-year losing streak with his son, Keno Davis. We had our first winning season. Keno then took over the program. We went 28-5 into the NCAA championship for the first time in 40 years. He put a zero on the end of his salary and went to Providence. And 3 years later was let go from Providence. He's at Central Michigan now, and my guess is he's going to get it done. I hope they have patience for him to do it the right way. It takes a while. Krzyzewski's the first guy to say, if I got hired right now, I'd get fired in the first 3 years. Culture doesn't happen overnight. Doing it right doesn't happen overnight. And I get troubled with all the conversation about creative ways to refund what we're doing. We have to get back to what we're supposed to be doing, in my opinion, and it's just not an easy thing to do. So specifically to your question, yes, the focus on the young people, and I think this centers around the fact that young people are recruited out of situations where they get their cash in lieu of their scholarship and they send half of it home and they don't have enough food to eat. That's a real situation. These things are really happening. It's not prevalent. It doesn't happen every kid everywhere in Division I athletics, but it is happening and it's not right. But to blow up our system, I think, it's a challenge. I'll go for about 17 more hours if you let me, so I'm going to turn it over to Oliver.
Your question is a very good one. We're typical, I think, of many big state schools. I just looked at the numbers recently. We have 144 full Pell Grant recipients amongst our 400 and so full scholarship athletes. So we've got a significant number of young men and women coming from difficult socioeconomic backgrounds. Folks often forget, I think you know this here in this panel, but folks often forget how many first-generation student-athletes we have at any big public university. These are kids going to college for the first time, so there's a massive adjustment. What's the best thing that I think any university can do from day one to identify any academic weakness a young man or woman may have. We just 2 years ago started to test for learning disabilities of all of our incoming student athletes. We had kids that were going through school for 4 or 5 years without being diagnosed for dyslexia or any of the other disabilities. And then once they're on campus, provide them with the absolute best 360 composite academic support, mental health support, tutor support, academic advising support, career training support, because all the data indicates that, you know, receiving that college degree is the best way to break whatever cycle of poverty may exist within that family. So that all costs money, as you all know, and supporting those staff is challenging very often, because often on campus, as many folks will remember, you know, you'll get some resistance from faculty because, boy, the athletics folks can really work with their kids and provide all these support services, but the average student may have to wait in line for, you know, 30, 45, 50 minutes, whatever, to have an appointment to talk about career training. So a good bit of our revenue does go to kind of create that 360 composite support group where we can help every young man and woman come through and get a meaningful degree.
I want to just say one thing, just because, and I'll be quiet, but just because I have this experience. I think what Myron's hitting on is exactly a major problem. You know, I came from a first-time family of college. I was the first one in the family to go to college. Alcoholic family system. Didn't fit in. I mean, thank God I wasn't as talented as you. Went to junior, you know, there are higher education institutions that are designed to accommodate folks in that situation. I went to junior college, went to regional state university, fit in with the other students in that situation. It's not just academic preparedness, it's the whole social feeling you have with the other students you're involved with. And I think that's a major issue that we have. We're bringing in student athletes who otherwise would have gone through another system and fit in with other students and been prepared to then, like I did, get to be able to go to law school and so forth. But we're putting them in an environment where they are not prepared, not just academically, but they haven't been around the same kind, generally, not to stereotype everybody. And I think that's a major issue, because I can't, if I'd had to go to University of Washington or one of those places rather than a regional state university or a junior college, I think it would have been a very trying circumstance that it would have ended in me just getting out of school and going back to the hometown and doing, you know, working in the print shop, you know. So I think it's a major challenge.
Okay, Lynn?
Thanks, Britt. First of all, thank you all for sharing your ideas. You know, I think a lot of them have legs if, you know, if we continue to think them through. The one thing I do want to emphasize in my comments, and hopefully it generates some response, you know, I really believe that everybody associated with college sports talks about the college or the university mission is to create leaders. And, you know, I certainly want to commend Drake and you, Sandy, for the idea that you're practicing it. You're etching it in essentially in stone, and trying to work through it where everybody talks about it and very few are willing to commit to the action that that you've taken to back it up. And, you know, I think that's a model to really take a close look at and, as you said, to exercise the patience in doing it. And Oliver, your idea of acknowledgement of college sports, particularly football and basketball, as big businesses, but we've got to continue to innovate to try and find ways to, you know, kind of get other revenue out of so-called non-revenue sports. They don't necessarily have to be profit centers, certainly to generate the revenue and find ways to kind of build on it. I think those are some terrific ideas. In fact, I wish my alma mater had done that before they made the jump to the Big Ten, but that's a whole different story. the one thing, though, that and with all due respect, Mike, I think the idea, the IP model, I think that's a dangerous model in my mind. Because what it does, it perpetuates a culture among young people of getting paid. And getting paid hard dollars as opposed to understanding the true value of what they're getting. I can't tell you how many times I've gone and spoken to young people, particularly in the basketball realm, only to hear them talk about getting paid because that's been spoken in their ears by others, whether it's their travel team coaches, whether it's the parents in the community. I mean, the idea of you know, sharing in the value that you create. You know, I understand that to a point, but, you know, what I do when I test these concepts of getting paid, I ask them, you know, if you're an average person going in on entry level to a job, you know, what's your value and, you know, what do you expect to get paid without an education as opposed to with an education? And therein lies the understanding of the value. When you talk about sharing in the value that they create, the aggregate royalty dollars that come from, you know, right to likeness, right to their likeness, et cetera, who decides who's really a value? I mean, you've got a quarterback that everybody, you know, seems to want to put on their shoulders and raise them, you know, above everyone else. But if the receiver doesn't catch the ball, if the left tackle doesn't block for him, where does that come? And, you know, who's really getting the true value? I think, again, Justice White, and I call it the free market value as well, Justice White's dissent in Board of Regents probably encapsulates essentially the rationale for limited protection to allow a strong central body to make these decisions. And I say limited simply because, you know, you don't want unfettered authority over everything by that one central authority. But nevertheless, to have the protections from, you know, lawsuits like the Kessler lawsuit, which, again, I think is this idea of free market, you know, presents a lot of issues. And, again, I want to be able to change the culture of the kids coming in and understanding that they do have value, that the value is coming to them. It's just not necessarily in hard dollars. Because ultimately, that's when, you know, you get the one-and-done mentality. That's ultimately when you get people who just want to be there just to be able to earn those hard dollars and then to move on. And I get it, and maybe it's a generational thing, but it's just something that I think we need to change. We need to change that culture. And I just don't think this so-called free market, this free market model is going to change that culture, and that's why it's very dangerous to college sports. I mean, if you guys have a comment, agree, disagree, I appreciate it.
Well, no, again, my background, I was an NCAA investigator way back in the day and spent a lot of time, as did Dan, going to groups of young men, especially, and saying, look, there's more to life. You're only one knee injury away from no future if you don't start to get it together academically. I now find myself having those conversations with young men at my high school, talking about the tremendous value of a college education. Like Dan, I'm the first one in my family, so I'm acutely aware of that. And again, your points are well taken. We understood drafting this. We had these conversations with ourselves. And the beauty is of your group is that you have a lot of intelligent folks that can spot the issues. So if some of this sticks, great. If it doesn't, it will fall on its merits as well. But where I'm concerned as a parent, I'm a huge proponent of the Division III world. I have blessed to have a healthy young man who plays Division III basketball. Missed 0 days of class due to basketball last year. I understand that probably is not a model that can be duplicated at Division I. But in my perfect world, that's where we're headed. So I find myself reluctantly agreeing with Dan that there is a lot to be said for a need-based approach to a lot of things. So to sum up back to this model, we can't dispute what you're saying, Len. You know, there is a danger. There is a risk. On the other hand, that's the world we're living in now. And I'll be fascinated to see where we go in the next decade.
Sonia.
I wanted to ask Mr. Luck if he could give me a sense of something. Dr. Handline, I think, made a very compelling case for the need for greater research into health and safety issues, led by research on concussions and brain injuries, because of what he pointed to as the dearth of medical data, especially with regard to football. And I just wondered if you have a sense of whether the Football Bowl Championship Committees is contributing or plans to contribute funding to that effort.
I am not aware there's any plan for the championship committee, which really is the 10 Division I football conference commissioners, to contribute to that. They could be, but I'm not aware of it. I think there is, as Dr. Handline mentioned, a good bit of money coming from the NCAA. The NFL is doing a lot of research as well, and often in conjunction with the NCAA and with General Electric. There's a lot of concussion research that is taking place. I'm not aware of any plans that the committee has to provide funding for that.
What would you think about taking part of the revenues that you're receiving and plowing some of that into that research, investing some of that?
Well, a good bit of that money is coming from the NCAA, and that ultimately is money that would be distributed to the universities based on the NCAA system. I think that's certainly an interesting approach. I would defer a little bit to the 10 commissioners who really oversee that entity.
Chuck?
I appreciate all of your comments. I think they've been valuable in that they've probably caused us all to think a little bit, and that's a useful thing. Let me start in by saying I'm probably one of the few people here who supported the O'Bannon case, talked to Housefield about it, but decided not to testify for a variety of reasons. And I wish the NCAA had settled early on, because they could have settled and made some of the issues that we're now dealing with clearer and limited the potential liabilities, because what they were really concerned about was the use of images in games and so forth and not pay for playing. And I hope it gets settled in that way. There's going to be a lot of new expenses if we do what we're supposed to do. And among them, in my opinion, is going back to a full lifetime scholarship, at least a 5-year scholarship, and I'd like to see it extended, as I guess it was Dr. Heinlein who said that. And ensuring that people who participate in intercollegiate athletics and are injured in that process are covered for life for what the injuries they receive. And there's going to be some additional expense resulting not so much from the O'Bannon case, but the follow-on, perhaps, of the O'Bannon case. But I'd like to see people talk about cutting expenses rather than increasing income. The Light Commission, one of the best things it ever did was the study that was a sustainability study, which indicated how income and expenses were growing in intercollegiate athletics as compared to how they're growing in the educational enterprise, the universities. I've been at this business for a long time because I'm older than most people. And my first NCAA convention was the convention, I think it was in Chicago, which was called the cost-cutting convention. The big cost cut was what? Teams couldn't wear blazers on trips. Let's talk about the way we can cut costs rather than the way we can raise more money. If I look at what has happened with regard to the television contracts, there's plenty of money out there. And that money's going to be spent. I have never seen a situation in which the intercollegiate athletic enterprise couldn't spend every penny that they got from new income. And they didn't spend it on things, in my opinion, for the most part, that are needed now. And they didn't end up spending it on the educational enterprise of the university. They ended up spending it on higher coaches' salaries, more coaches, more trainers, more recruiters, more everything. But again, if I look at the data, I think I can safely say that the percentage of the total income to the intercollegiate athletic programs in our universities and our conferences that is going to the students is a smaller and smaller percentage every year. So let's cut back on the other things other than what is really helping the students. To do what Dan says, it seems to me would be counterproductive. To say, we're gonna provide good benefits to all the students who are participating in income-producing activities, and we're going to take it away from all the others. I think that would send the wrong message. I think it would be the wrong thing to do. I hope that those who are not as removed from criticism and really important issues that might affect them decide that is not a good idea. I hope that what you're doing at Drake does all that you hope it will. I want to see the final results, but I'm very pleased that you're going in that direction. But we also need to keep doing the things that will enable us to continue to support the non-income sports activities. The non-income sports activities are the Olympic activities. So, but I do hope at some point in time we'll sit down and talk about, and if I look through the recommendations of the Knight Commission previously, an awful lot of them had to do with cutting. And I don't see any evidence that any of that has been done.
Any comment from the panel? Okay, we have time for two more questions. We have Val and then Carol.
Thanks, Britt. Thanks to the panelists. I'm going to direct this, I think, to Mr. Ashley, but any can jump in. And Alan, I'm choosing you because some look at the Amateur Sports Act of 78 as potentially good precedent in how a functional Congress could address complex problems in sport. And given the complexities facing the NCAA and the collision that we're now seeing as between or among, I guess it's more than one, two, so it has to be among, the antitrust laws, the labor laws, Title IX, sort of the economic challenges that you and many of our colleagues here have talked about and we've debated in many meetings, and then, of course, all the policy issues, because this is all in the context of higher education. Some have suggested that a congressional solution, if it exists, might be the path. And I guess I was wondering if, you know, any of the panelists have a view on that. Is that the answer or an answer? Should it be explored? Should there be a commission that could be established to look into how all of these pieces fit together? What would be the downside of that? Much is being written. I know that the NCAA has done some exploration on this and certainly something we've discussed here, so I'd be curious to get your views, Alan, and then anybody's on whether that's the way to go. Thanks.
Well, really, I can only speak to the fact that, you know, we do manage carefully to the Amateur Sports Act of 1978, and that is what established the U.S. Olympic Committee and the national governing bodies. And I think that, in any piece of legislation, you can look at the pros and cons of it. But what we've really found, I think, as being productive is just to accept it for what it is and then try to do the very, very best job we can for the athletes, for the sports within the legislation and protect the rights of the athletes and try to organize ourselves to compete successfully internationally. As far as this particular issue and how that would, how a commission would address it, to be honest with you, we haven't discussed that as an option. We've really been talking about how do we figure out within our existing systems ways to partner with the member institutions, with the various organizations around collegiate sport, and see if there are solutions that we can work out together there without any discussion about legislative interaction.
Val, I don't think that you can get to what Chuck's aiming at necessarily internally. You can proclaim all you want about cutting costs and diverting revenue towards other things than coaches' salaries and facilities. But if you're the athletics director, and I've seen it with presidents too, at an institution where your coach just won the national championship in football, and this has happened in the Big 12 years ago, and then he starts to be recruited by other institutions, represented in some part in this room, and you don't keep them, they'll have an athletics director soon after he leaves that would pay enough to keep him. And that's just the truth. Or if you're not following what that coach, that successful coach, is saying about what he needs in terms of facilities, staffing, and others, it won't matter. You won't be there to provide that kind of support in the future with the revenue that's coming in. So I'm not sure that internally this can be corrected by the collegiate community. And, you know, I don't have, we've seen the numbers on Congress, and, you know, I'm not sure that they can adopt anything that would be popular right now, but I think you point to something that needs to possibly be considered, because I don't see the ability to do it. You can stand up. I've been in front of presidents who have taken on coaches and mics in my world and that have been cheating, and they said, look me in the eye, said, I don't think I'm going to make it here because I'm trying to hold the fire to this coach, and there are supporters and board members who are going to remove me from doing the right thing. So that's a reality. And that's a reality also in the payment for coaches, the payment for facilities. We can all bolster up and say, I would do this. I wouldn't have paid this coach this or that. But when you get there and you have a family support and everything else, it goes a different direction, especially when you have a very successful coach. And I don't know that it can be done internally to try to contain that kind of revenue source. My deal about need-based aid in the Olympic sports is not to get rid of those, but to enhance them and even grow them to a larger degree and provide even more Olympic support than we have now.
Carol, you get the last question. Okay. And just to your point, what would you think about, I think this is the case in some of the professional sports, that there was a limit on of the amount of money you could spend in a given sport, let's say football. So is a way of controlling the expenses without running into antitrust issues?
Well, you know, I'm not a real lawyer and that I've never practiced. I went right into college athletics, so I guess I'd trust that if that's the case, if you could have the national organization adopt a rule that each program has to only spend can only spend a certain amount in each sport, and they'd have to figure out how to do it, perhaps that's an avenue. I would say there's probably going to be some challenges about institutions that are in certain locations versus others. You're going to be tremendously advantaged at Chuck's old institution in UCLA with a, you know, population base of over $10 million in recruiting and other activities. So I don't know how you determine the metrics that allow certain institutions to spend more perhaps than others. Marketplaces where it costs a heck of a lot more to live for your staff. Seattle versus Pullman, you know, in my home state. So that might be a place to go, but I think you're going to have immense challenges in making sure that you try to provide some sort of equality among institutions.
Brett, if I could just mention from another lawyer's perspective, the last time the NCAA tried to regulate coaches' salaries, there was a lawsuit, the restricted earnings, right. The third basketball coach, if you all remember, that's 15 right. years ago. Yeah, and that did not end up well for
no,
the NCAA.
No, it did not. I mean, but this wouldn't be a limit on salaries per se, but on how much could be spent in a given sport. Anyway, maybe not a practical idea.
Right, a coach's salary cap as well.
Last comment.
I was just going to add, I think, though, you hit on the key of creating success within our model, because certainly at Drake University, where we're a school where our coaches are picked off all the time, as I just shared a story a minute ago. But as we just hired a year ago our men's basketball coach, I told him during the recruitment process, we're not a place that will ever pay $1 million salary. It doesn't make sense for Drake University, regardless of the success that we will have in the future. And so it's about recruiting the right individual to our institution, building it the right way, coaching it the right way. I have to provide him the resources to be successful. We just built an $8.3 million practice facility. So I'm not talking out of both sides of my mouth here. When we sat down and talked about how are we going to do this and provide the resources that we must have at Drake University to create the type of success that we want to have, let's sit down and ask what's right for Drake. Our model was a $5 million facility, which then I had to go out and lead the fundraising for an $8.3 million model so it would serve the entire institution and not just the athletics program. So it's, again, doing it within the academic mission of the institution. So we can't be, all of us are held accountable to building, putting together the right model. But at the same time, I just think there's a smarter approach. It comes down to human behavior, and whether it's governmental intervention or it's lawsuits or what have you, we have to find a way to bring ourselves as a group of individuals to a place where we're a little bit smarter about how we're approaching it.
Well, let me thank the panel members for wonderful presentations and a very illuminating and engaging discussion. So please join me in expressing that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. For more information on the Knight Commission, please visit knightcommission.org.